Chapter 6. Pleasing the Guru. The young man says, "You, Yogi, who are the living Buddha, although many know the Dharma, few can practice it." Aware of his great good fortune in finding Milarepa, and of this tremendous opportunity, the young man is now even keener to place himself under Milarepa's instruction, if the master will only accept him. In the opening lines of his song, the would-be disciple puts his finger on a crucial, if apparently rather elementary, point. That while intellectual understanding is relatively common, actual practice and ultimate realization is very rare. But to dismiss this point as elementary would be to miss it altogether. It is easy to take the point. It is much more difficult to apply it to our own situation. We tend not to realize how much we identify with what we think we know rather than what we actually know from our own experience. Entranced by theory, and perhaps rather alienated from our experience, we find that trying to put spiritual principles into practice has none of the alluring charm of the play of ideas, but that, as the youth quite rightly observes, it is simply hard work. We can almost inevitably imagine that, if we know something in conceptual terms, we really do know it. The amount of knowledge that one can amass about Buddhism can become very impressive, without necessarily leaving any impression in terms of practice, even at the most elementary level. Even the ability to write books about Buddhism can make a formidable contrast with what is put into daily practice. But the young man values Milarepa's teaching as arising from, he says, hard work. It is not only that very few people try to put the teachings into practice. The youth says that few people have the capacity to practice. The implication seems to be that, in view of our knowledge of the clear benefits of practicing the Dharma, the fact that we fail to do so must be acknowledged as a kind of disability. It is a disability that can be overcome, but it runs very deep. The young man says, "One in hundreds is hard to find who can give proof of his accomplishment." The young man goes on to say that it is hard to find one among hundreds, presumably hundreds of those who practice the spiritual life, who can give proof of his accomplishment. This calls to mind Sri Krishna's famous observation in the Bhagavad Gita that, quote, "Among 1,000 people, perhaps only one searches for me, and out of 1,000 who search for me, perhaps only one finds me." But how is it possible to give proof of accomplishment? There is no way to prove beyond doubt that someone has reached a given level of spiritual attainment. This is one of the themes of the Diamond Sutra, that even if you have the 32 major and 68 minor marks of a great man, this does not prove that you are a Buddha. A yogi may be leading a life of great simplicity and self-denial, but someone unsympathetic to what the yogi is trying to do will see only a destitute beggar. This is exactly the view taken by Milarepa's own sister. She is quite scathing on the subject of his status as a yogi. The only evidence she is prepared to recognize is what she can see, temples and numerous disciples, and the financial rewards that come with them. She remarks derisively that Milarepa is so wretched that he hasn't even a blanket with which to cover his nakedness. And even if one is disposed to be rather more impressed by outward signs of spiritual ability than Milarepa's materially minded sister, one must bear in mind that even his ability to walk on water shows only either that he has supernormal powers or that he can provoke hallucinations. It doesn't prove transcendental insight. Yet the young man shows complete faith in Milarepa, due to his own readiness to follow the spiritual path. Come what may, he knows that Milarepa must be his guru. The only proof of someone's transcendental attainment is one's own intuitive conviction. Clearly, this is what has led the young man to make his decisive commitment to follow Milarepa. There is nothing provisional about his decision, no question of making do with Milarepa until the next guru comes along. From what he says, he isn't wondering whether, if this doesn't work out, he might find a guru who suits him better or who can work bigger miracles. Flitting from guru to guru is a weakness that is not confined to the West. The closest friend I made in my time in Kalimpong, Dada Rinpoche, who was also my teacher, told me that the Tibetans are as prone to it as anyone else. When he arrived in Kalimpong in the late 1940s, as the only incarnate Lama in the town, he was the object of great respect and devotion. It was Rinpoche this and Rinpoche that, and he received offerings and invitations and performed ceremonies and blessings for people morning, noon and night. A few years later, another incarnate Lama arrived, and almost overnight, Dada Rinpoche was dropped in favour of the new Lama in town. As more and more Lamas turned up, and by the time I settled there, dozens of Lamas had crossed over the mountains to Kalimpong as refugees, the townsfolk became quite dizzy with indecision. They were unable to resist the temptation to sample the latest spiritual sensation, be it a head Lama or the chief abbot of a great monastery, or the incarnation of this bodhisattva or that siddha. And when they heard that the Dorje Lama, the one and only female incarnation, was on her way, everyone naturally wanted to be among the first to get her blessing. Of course, the eminent gurus didn't play along with this cupidity on the part of their disciples. For example, there were three great Nyingma gurus in Kalimpong who, because they were closely connected in terms of their common tradition and knew each other quite well, were the subject of considerable speculation with regard to their comparative status. Eventually, a disciple of all three summoned up the nerve to ask one of them, very politely, to satisfy everyone's curiosity. Was one of them greater than the other two, and if so, which of them was it? The guru thought for a moment, and then he said, "Well, I'll tell you how things stand. As a matter of fact, one of us is much more developed than the others. But as for which one it is, none of you people will ever know." The type of teaching offered by a guru might not suit one's temperament, and this might be a good reason for seeking out another. A little shopping around might be appropriate at the initial stages of one's spiritual career. But there are people who spend their whole lives drifting from one teacher to another. Why? It often has to do with a half-conscious expectation that the guru can somehow do it all for you. When you have been with a particular guru for a while and nothing much seems to have happened, it is often the guru whom you find wanting rather than your own efforts. And if you find yourself in this position, the sheer novelty of a new guru with a new set of teachings, new practices, even new jokes, all promising a new beginning and fresh hope, is very appealing. So instead of refreshing your spiritual practice by digging deeper into it, you trade in your stale old guru for an exciting new one. Milarepa himself, as he says in the opening song of this episode, called off his search for a guru as soon as he heard Marpa's name. After that, his path was one of complete submission to his guru's wishes. Even though Marpa himself led a householder's life with a wife and family, when he insisted that Milarepa should follow the solitary life of a hermit, Milarepa did not question his decision. This is not to say that Marpa could literally order Milarepa to do anything. That is not how a spiritual relationship works. There can be no desire on the part of any follower of the Dharma to exert power over anyone else. Power has no place in the spiritual community, and that includes the relationship between a tantric guru and his disciple. But the nature of the guru-disciple relationship is such that a guru's quietest hints or gentlest recommendations have the force of commands for his heart disciples. As it happens, Marpa is unlikely to have expressed himself with reticence. It was not his way. By all accounts, he was a rather peppery character, and one can't imagine him saying, "This is just a suggestion, but I think it would be a good idea for you to spend the rest of your life in solitude up a remote mountain." He would just have barked at Milarepa, "Off you go." And Milarepa, being Milarepa, would have obeyed instantly, but not because he was under Marpa's thumb. It is the receptivity of the disciple that gives the force of a command to the guru's suggestions or orders. However loudly Marpa barked at him, Milarepa was free to do as he pleased. His obedience sprang entirely from his supreme receptivity to his guru. Without this unquestioning attitude, the relationship between a guru and his disciple will not work, because any such relationship is naturally volatile, being based, in a sense, on a conflict of interests. For example, if you obey a guru in order to win his approval, he is more than likely to withhold that approval. You might appear to be doing all sorts of good and virtuous things, when in fact you're just looking for recognition from the guru. And when he spots this, he will not pat you on the back. After all, it is the ego in us that wants praise from the guru. But the guru's role is to knock the ego on the head, so to speak, not pat it on the back. So if the guru is doing his job, your grasping after approval will not be satisfied, but possibly give way to resentment and disappointment in your teacher. Feeling let down, thinking he doesn't appreciate you, you may become sullen and uncooperative. This is particularly unfortunate. Your relationship with the guru is, after all, more than just ordinary friendship. He embodies your highest aspiration, so if you reject him, you lose your connection with your own guiding ideals. He will, of course, remain open to you, but you might close off the channel of communication from your side, and even start to find fault with him. Looking for faults in the teacher or guru can be a way of unconsciously evading one's spiritual responsibility. If one consciously accepts certain principles, one should feel a responsibility to put them into practice. If one then fails to do so, finding fault with the teacher is a convenient way of explaining away one's failure. One might find oneself blaming the teacher, or even the whole Sangha. To the extent that the spiritual community as a whole represents a sort of collective guru figure in relation to oneself, one may come to see it in an entirely negative light. There is a broader principle here which can be applied to the way we see anyone. We may be well aware of other people's behaviour as skillful or unskillful, but we must try not to pass narrow moral judgment on them. Never mind whether the judgment is negative or positive. The principle is that we shouldn't judge people simply in terms of virtues and faults. So how should we see other people? We can't help seeing them in some way or another, and we will certainly see both their faults and their virtues. But we shouldn't see them exclusively in those terms. We shouldn't reduce them to good or bad or a combination of the two. The best way is to see them as living, growing, developing human beings. If we are to do justice to others, we must always consider what they do in the context of the person doing it. Their deeds shouldn't be seen in isolation from the overall growth and development of the individual. In short, we should always try to see the person, not what he or she does. The more carefully you try to look at someone, the more difficult it seems to be to know and judge them. Naturally, their actions do express something of their character. But as well as understanding the person in the light of their actions, you have to understand their actions in the light of the person. The same goes for what they say. To understand someone's words fully, you have to relate them back to the person speaking them. Suppose someone repeats to you something that a friend of yours has said, or describes something your friend has done, without knowing your friend very well. As you know your friend better than they do, you will probably understand what they said or did rather better than them, and you may be able to explain that there has been a misunderstanding. Sometimes the person behind the action or words is bigger than the actions or the words, and sometimes, of course, he or she is smaller. But you cannot arrive at any real knowledge of a person simply through knowing what they have done or said, without reference to who they are as a whole. Tibetans and tantric practitioners generally make a great deal of the point that the disciple cannot really understand the actions of the guru. While this can be made the basis of a lot of humbug and even exploitation, in principle it is true. You cannot fully understand the words or the actions of someone more developed than yourself, any more than a dog can fully understand the words or actions of its master. If this analogy seems brutal, it might help to reflect that while a dog can never become a human being, as a disciple, you can equal and surpass the spiritual attainments of your guru, if you want to. Once we start passing moral judgment on people, our tendency is to see faults rather than virtues. At least it is the faults that seem to stand out. But there is a particular danger in passing judgment on the character of our teacher, as we will then lose faith in him and his advice, and we will no longer be able to commit ourselves wholeheartedly to the ideals to which he has introduced us. Indeed, to the extent that we are out of communication with him, we are cutting ourselves off from our inspiration and undermining our practice. The young man says, "Your teachings spring from much hard work, and so I dare not ask without paying first. I now offer you this knife and belt. Later I will ask you for the teachings." Milarepa had to perform all sorts of tasks for Marpa before he was given Marpa's compassionate blessing and the teachings he needed. Marpa himself had to pay in gold for the teachings that he had gathered in India. But Milarepa is a different sort of guru. He will not accept such offerings. So what can the young man do to get the teachings? Traditionally, the Dharma cannot be bought. Any material support received is not linked to the teaching given, because to make such a link suggests some kind of equivalence in value between the teaching and whatever mundane wealth is offered in return for it, which is crucially to misrepresent the nature of the Dharma. At the same time, one has to be prepared to make an offering of one's material wealth as a token of one's commitment to spiritual values above mundane ones. The young man certainly has a robust understanding of this attitude. When he says, I dare not ask without paying first, he means that he would be ashamed to do so. But he's not asking for the teachings there and then. He's now prepared to leave a decent interval between the offering and the request. It is a question not of bargaining for the Dharma, but of putting one's money where one's mouth is. For money is what we are talking about here. Money is the easiest thing to give. It is specifically designed for ease of disbursement. All you have to do is put your hand in your pocket and take the stuff out, or sign a cheque, and hand it over. Yet it is sometimes money that we find most difficult to give. The teachings we want from the Guru are the fruit of perhaps decades of determined application to meditation, of hardship and privation, and we want it all for nothing. Marpa said as much to Milarepa himself. According to the life of Milarepa, when Milarepa first asked for the teachings, Marpa replied, "Is it to reward your many crimes that I went to India at the risk of my life? You say you want these teachings, which are the living breath of the Dakinis, and for which, disdaining riches, I offered gold without measure. I only hope you are joking. Anyone else would kill you for that." The difficulty we experience in parting with our money is a symbolic recognition of the much greater difficulty the teacher has experienced in the course of his own mastery of the teachings. Giving as generously as you can is thus what makes a meeting between teacher and disciple possible. The meeting is based on a mutual recognition of what is truly important, that the worldly value of the offering is as nothing when compared to the value of the teaching. The Tantra therefore traditionally insists on a significant financial outlay to signify the full commitment of your energies and resources. Originally, the disciple was meant to give his entire worldly wealth. At the time of Tantric initiation, you brought along all your property, usually made portable in the form of a bag of gold, and you offered it all to the Guru. Later, this was changed, and you were asked instead to make a substantial cash payment, however much you could manage. If you think about it, this is not necessarily a watering down of the principle, because it still exposes any lack of commitment on your part. When you are told you can give what you like, the struggle going on in your mind may be all too apparent. Shall I give 100, or might I get away with 50? Maybe I should give 60 to be on the safe side. Someone in this position might find they were less concerned about how much they could give for the teaching than how little they could get it for, or that they were tempted to hedge their bets in case the teachings proved not to transform their life as advertised. If you are betrayed by a loss of nerve, an unspoken admission that you are going to allow your spiritual life to be governed by mundane considerations, this is a sure sign of a lack of spiritual receptivity. There is often a degree of misunderstanding with regard to money and the spiritual life. People think that if you are a holy person, you shouldn't be concerned with anything as grubby as money. The whole subject of cash is regarded in spiritual circles as rather indecent. But money is not sordid. It's just that we tend to become sordid when money is involved. We associate money with the mean, grasping attitude that it can tend to arouse in us, rather than seeing it as a way of expressing generosity and open-handedness. A more significant misunderstanding in this context is the idea that teachings of this nature can be given external form and placed at our disposal in the way that information can be gained from a book or a seminar, a lecture or a conversation. A guru's teaching is not a commodity. You can't acquire it from books or special mantras. It is a meeting of minds, a communication in the sense of a mutual resonance between individuals. And it can take place only when both people are completely open and unguarded and have no expectations in terms of the content of the communication. Even if all the communication seems to be flowing one way, it is more than that one-way flow. It's not like a file being downloaded from one computer to another. It is always an exchange. The teacher is, by definition, open to the disciple. His wisdom is compassionate in nature, and he is simply waiting for an opportunity to give it. But he can do so only if the disciple is receptive. Given that the disciple is, again by definition, more restricted in his or her view of reality and of what the teaching means, the teacher must sometimes simply hold back. To use a traditional metaphor, if your pot is upside down, the guru cannot pour anything into it. If you are expecting the teacher to give to you, you must be willing to be generous yourself. It is only when the generosity of the teacher meets that of the disciple that communication can really happen. The willingness to give is more than just a sign of receptivity. It is receptivity. When you give something valuable, you give up your attachment to it and show your confidence in the teacher. The fact that you get the teaching once you've paid up does not mean that you've paid for it. The payment is the manifestation of the openness you need if you are to receive the teaching. The willingness to give everything shows that you are fearless and that you have complete faith in the teacher. It is also a discarding of old ideas about what is important and what is not. Of course, it is better to think in terms of paying for the Dharma than not to give at all. A misunderstanding may be cleared up in the course of time, but if you never start giving up your attachments, you will never start receiving the Dharma. Giving is a spiritual practice in itself, and that practice is all the guru wants to see, whether or not they are the personal recipient of your generosity. Giving is a habit to be cultivated. If you are wealthy, it may be easier to make the gesture of a big public donation than to make a habit of being generous on a day-to-day basis. And you may have to work towards that kind of ongoing generosity slowly. But if you have only 2 coins and you give both of them, you really are giving up everything, although no one is likely to be very impressed. The quiet generosity of those who possess almost nothing is a treasure in itself. This reminds me of an occasion during my time in Kalimpong. It was in 1956 when I was invited by the Indian government as one of 57 distinguished Buddhists from border areas to visit Delhi for the 2500th Buddha Jayanti or birthday celebrations. In the course of our travels, we came to Benares, where, in the company of a Tibetan friend, I visited an old Tibetan Lama who was living there in order to learn Sanskrit. Apparently, the Dalai Lama had asked him to teach, but he had refused. Although he was about 50, which is old for a Tibetan, he said he had too much still to learn and that he had to complete his studies first. We found him in a small bare room at the top of a Hindu ashram, seated on the floor behind a tin trunk, which he was using as a makeshift desk. He was very happy to meet us, and we talked for about an hour and a half. As we rose to go, he said, "Wait, I must give you something." He looked around the room, which didn't take long because there was nothing in it, seemingly almost desperate to find something that would serve as a gift. Suddenly his face cleared. He took his mala, the string of beads on which the recitation of mantras is counted, broke the cord, and gave me one of the beads. "Please take this," he said. "It is all I have, but I must have said many millions of mantras with it over the years." This gift from this poor and humble monk was worthless in material terms, but in spiritual terms it was immensely valuable. Through this eloquent reminder of his years of practice, he was offering the Dharma, which is the best gift anyone can give or receive. Returning to Milarepa, he probably doesn't even have a mala, but he does have the Dharma, and consequently he rejects any implication that he has any need or desire for anything that can be bought or sold, given or taken away. But implicit in the young man's choice of gifts and his manner of giving them, there is still a sense of worldly exchange, an assumption that the treasure of Milarepa's attainment and his instruction has its worldly price. As each gift is offered, Milarepa counters it with a fresh restatement of his attainment, which is beyond valuation. The very basis of that attainment is, after all, the letting go of worldly objects. Milarepa tells the young man that he cannot yet give him the teachings, and explains why. "Listen to me, ingenuous young man. From my hut's roof in the snow mountain flows the quintessence of milk and nectar. Though it is not made of gold or jewels, I would not pour it into earthenware." There is a rich confusion of images here. The quintessence of milk and nectar refers to the dissolving of the yogi's subtle energies into the bliss of the enlightened mind. It also recalls meditation practices in which one imagines a bright, nourishing stream of nectar pouring down on one's head from a visualized archetypal figure above. Milarepa poetically conflates this image with the melting snow dripping from the roof of his hut. But as he develops the image and envisages pouring the milk and nectar, it comes to refer to the teaching distilled from his meditation. Although he cannot claim that his own teaching is very precious, quote, "it is not made of gold or jewels," unquote, it is the most precious thing he has to offer, and he wants to be very careful where he pours it. Not only must the vessel be receptive, the pot must be the right way up, but it cannot be made of just any old earthenware. In other words, our practice is not to fill ourselves with profound and precious teachings, but to make ourselves fit to receive them, to become a strong, unbreakable vessel, even a diamond vessel. Milarepa next points to the cotton belt around his waist, which is probably the meditation band he wears round his neck and knees to keep his body upright during his hours and days of meditation practice. "Around this waist of mine, the poor man of strong will is tied a cotton belt of fanatic devotion. The absence of pretense and hypocrisy is the pattern of my belt." In symbolizing fanatic devotion, or perhaps intense would be a better translation, for nothing that is truly Buddhist can really be described as fanatic, the belt needs no embellishments. Milarepa's devotion does not draw attention to itself. His practice is held together by a simplicity of faith and direct and diligent honesty of purpose. The image is reminiscent of the biblical phrase, "Gird up thy loins," that is, hitch up your robe, ready for work. His devotion is a practical and realistic response to the true nature of things. "Bright wisdom is my knife, its sheath, the confidence of the three measurements." As is customary, wisdom is likened to a blade with its associations of cutting, penetrating, and reflecting. Intellectual understanding, by contrast, is represented here by the image of the sheath. Milarepa's sheath is his confidence in his practice, based on the three measurements, which Chang suggests refers to the yogi's judgment of how far his experience matches his understanding of the scriptures, and whether it brings him closer to the bodhisattva ideal and deepens his insight. His wisdom, however penetrating, is thus always put in the context of his understanding of these scriptures. Like a sheath, his understanding protects his wisdom. Milarepa: lest goddesses punish me, I have never asked for wealth or money when teaching in the past, nor shall I do so now. Dear boy, you may go home. I do not want your gifts. Milarepa is not questioning the importance for the disciple of making offerings before the teachings can be received, but he is mindful of the danger for the teacher of losing sight of the subtlety of the principle involved and demanding cash for teachings. It is a little like the communist principle: to each according to his need, from each according to his ability. There is no cash nexus, no bargain struck. Rather than, I give you this, therefore you give me that, the principle is, I will try to give you what I can, with no relation to anything you may or may not give to me. If the guru is a real guru, he will give what he can in any case. Milarepa is beyond being able to sell his teachings. There is no literal danger of being punished by the goddesses, by which he presumably means the Dakinis representing his inspiration, because he is not separate from them. They are not external deities looking on in judgment. But he is saying that his ability to communicate the teachings is linked to his inability to sell them. The goddesses, the Dakinis and inspirational muses, are there to be served, not used. And if you try to exploit them for your own ends, they will desert you. The same principle applies to the powers of inspiration, to which people like artists, psychics, and mystics have at least intermittent access. If those powers are not honoured, they can indeed be lost. A creative artist who starts using his or her talent to produce work simply to make money is likely to find that the springs of inspiration will eventually dry up. This certainly happened to fashionable society painters like the 19th century English prodigy John Millais, who began his career as an artist with real promise and then went on to turn out popular sentimental works like Bubbles. Likewise, spiritual teachers who are bursting with positive creative energy when they set up their own organisation or ashram can find that if they follow the lure of wealth and celebrity, when they start becoming successful, their gift leaves them. Not everyone succumbs to such pressures, of course. For example, some lamas and gurus who could have expected to live out their lives quietly in Tibet have evidently adjusted to the pressures of Western culture and withstood its temptations rather better than others. Unfortunately, once someone finds that they can heal people or teach people to meditate and that they can get paid to do so, the vocation can easily turn into a profession, becoming essentially a money-making enterprise rather than being generated by inspiration. You might start off idealistically, but the idealism can fade away quickly if you get caught up in maximizing profits. Whether it is writing or painting or practicing medicine or alternative therapies or even going into Buddhism and meditation, these days almost the first consideration seems to be how you're going to get a rewarding livelihood out of whatever you are inspired to do. But if you embark on yoga classes or therapy simply in order to become a yoga teacher or a therapist, or if you sit down to write a best-selling novel, you are never going to feel the breath of the Dakinis on the back of your neck as you work. The essence of spiritual inspiration is that it is free and spontaneous. Spiritual attainments should never be used, even for a good purpose. Even directing one's creativity towards some purely unselfish aim is to abuse it. Creativity will find its own uses, its own expression. It has its own momentum, and to try to harness it to a practical purpose is to deny its very nature. We see it as a good thing to try to put everything to good use, however trivial that use may be, and we feel uneasy if we can't put our finger on what something is for. But that uneasiness comes down to not knowing what we ourselves are for. We are uneasy with the thought that we are not here for anything. But the truth of the matter is that we are the glorious end product of millions of years of evolution, and we need find no further justification for ourselves. One of the less appealing legacies of Christianity is its encouragement of an unnecessarily abject view of ourselves. Charles Wesley, one of the founders of Methodism, liked to remind his congregations that they were mere grovelling worms. But the truth is that, splendid though worms are in their own way, we can safely claim to have left that species behind us by a comfortable margin. Indeed, without being unduly immodest, we can call ourselves the end product, even the crown, of the evolutionary process. Our human existence is much more significant than we usually like to think. We can have no higher purpose than being ourselves. The only step worth taking from where we find ourselves as human beings is to evolve into Buddhas. We are not here to be useful. We don't have to justify our human status by engaging in some useful occupation. Of course, there is nothing wrong with useful occupation, but we should beware of any idea that our purpose on this earth is to fill up our time with useful activities. In this context, consider the traditional life of the Buddhist monk. Though he is supported by the laity, there is no pressure on him to make himself useful. The fact that he is a monk is quite enough. All that is expected of him is that he should wear his robe correctly, keep his head shaved, eat his food at the proper time, and that sort of thing. He doesn't even have to meditate. Just living the harmless life of a monk is considered an achievement in itself. This attitude may encourage laziness, and it must be admitted that some monks don't really deserve the respect and support they receive. But the danger is more than offset by the important message that such a radical attitude communicates, which is that the spiritual life is not to be expected to produce material results. In fact, the majority of monks in the East do take up useful occupations like teaching or caring for the sick. But ideally they do this because they are inspired to do it. It is a spontaneous activity, an expression of what they are. Clergy in the West are impressively active and outgoing by comparison, but this seems to be at the cost of surrendering this principle. Out of concern to justify their existence in terms that the mundane world can appreciate, by engaging in social and charity work, like running youth clubs for teenagers and bingo for pensioners, they may end up neglecting their central function so that people start to wonder what they are really for, beyond providing a kind of social service. One can say, perhaps, that the job of religious full-timers is to demonstrate that the most important thing you can do is to be. The spiritual life is an end in itself and doesn't have to be justified in worldly terms. In the work and profit-driven culture of the West, we should do more than pay lip service to this ideal. We should do what we can to support at least a few people simply to live a Buddhist life without any expectation that they should earn their keep in some way, whether by teaching or writing or study, or even by working especially hard at their meditation. The only way to experience the value of doing this is to do it. You have actually to experience paying for someone to do nothing in particular. Or, more demanding still, you have to experience being paid to do nothing in particular. Being supported in this way, your contribution then is simply to be happy in whatever you choose to do or not do. You might do things like giving lectures, meditating or writing. You might do nothing much at all. You might simply be around for people to talk to. And even then, your job, in inverted commas, is to be happy, whether anyone talks to you or not. To do this would be to introduce into our lives a little of the fragrance, the essence of Sukhavati, the pure land, beloved of Buddhist mythology. You don't have to work there, because clothes and food appear spontaneously. All you need do is sit on a lotus and listen to the Dharma. Ideally, everything we do should have something of this spirit about it. If we work, it should be because we want to, because it makes us happy. Of course, we may sometimes be aware of the spiritual need to push ourselves through barriers of laziness or diffidence. But we should not be working just to fulfill an obligation to put in so many hours in return for pay. Too many people work on the basis of a deep-seated feeling of guilt and obligation, and people also exploit and manipulate others on the same basis. One of the functions of a Buddhist organization should therefore be to provide material support without strings attached, for those who are able to commit themselves fully to the spiritual life. It may be, as yet, difficult to achieve this on a large scale in the West, but one or two models of that way of going about things will at least remind us of that ideal. It would remind us that it is the human being that matters, the human being that is the whole purpose of any truly spiritual movement. Any Buddhist movement runs the risk of allowing its aspirations to sink to the level of purely organizational goals, and once these take hold, it is a small step to start to regard the human beings that make up that movement as little more than the means of realizing those organizational ends. We need always to remind ourselves of our real aim, however inconvenient and impractical it may be to do so. If a human being is a means to do anything, it is to his or her development as an individual. And if an individual is a means to do anything, it is to Buddhahood. Imagine the job of doing nothing in particular, not out of laziness, but as a practice of embodying the sheer enormity of a reality that exceeds any mundane notion of occupation or utility. Paradoxically, it would be quite challenging. People do not always take cheerfully to being left to their own devices. The devil, as they say, finds work for idle hands to do. And at the very least, you're likely to get bored and restless and start to seek distraction. But imagine having someone around who has nothing to rush off and do, who is not tired or busy, who is cheerful, peaceful, yet full of energy, and available to respond to the calls of the Dakini in whatever form they might take. Such a duty could be taken up successfully only by someone who was spiritually committed. After all, how would you employ a Buddha? Does he have to justify his Buddhahood? No. The mere fact that he is a Buddha is enough. By the same token, we can cultivate the vision of Buddhahood by resisting the impulse to make a commodity of ourselves. Our highest aspiration should be to take freely and give freely, acting spontaneously in everything we do, rather than out of a sense of obligation or even responsibility. As far as we can, we should abjure all coercive attempts to make us justify our existence by paying our way and working for our keep.